Chapter 41. Showing what became of Martin and his desperate resolve after he left Mr. Pecksniff's house, what persons he encountered, what anxieties he suffered, and what news he heard, carrying Tom Pinch's book quite unconsciously under his arm, and not even buttoning his coat as a protection against the heavy rain, Martin went doggedly forward at the same quick pace, until he had passed the finger post, and was on the high road to London. He slackened very little in his speed even then, but he began to think, and look about him, and to disengage his senses from the coil of angry passions which hitherto had held him prisoner. It must be confessed that, at that moment, he had no very agreeable employment either for his moral or his physical perceptions. The day was dawning from a patch of watery light in the east, and sullen clouds came driving up before it, from which the rain descended in a thick, wet mist. It streamed from every twig and bramble in the hedge, made little gullies in the path, ran down 100 channels in the road, and punched innumerable holes into the face of every pond and gutter. It fell with an oozy, slushy sound among the grass, and made a muddy kennel of every furrow in the ploughed fields. No living creature was anywhere to be seen. The prospect could hardly have been more desolate if animated nature had been dissolved in water, and poured down upon the earth again in that form. The range of view within the solitary traveller was quite as cheerless as the scene without. Friendless and penniless, incensed to the last degree, deeply wounded in his pride and self-love, full of independent schemes, and perfectly destitute of any means of realizing them, his most vindictive enemy might have been satisfied with the extent of his troubles. To add to his other miseries, he was by this time sensible of being wet to the skin, and cold at his very heart. In this deplorable condition he remembered Mr. Pinch's book, more because it was rather troublesome to carry, than from any hope of being comforted by that parting gift. He looked at the dingy lettering on the back, and finding it to be an odd volume of The Bachelor of Salamanca, apostrophe in the French tongue, cursed Tom Pinch's folly 20 times. He was on the point of throwing it away, in his ill humor and vexation, when he bethought himself that Tom had referred him to a leaf, turned down, and opening it at that place, that he might have additional cause of complaint against him for supposing that any cold scrap of the bachelor's wisdom could cheer him in such circumstances, found. Well, well, not much, but Tom's all. The half sovereign. He had wrapped it hastily in a piece of paper, and pinned it to the leaf. These words were scrawled in pencil on the inside. I don't want it indeed. I should not know what to do with it, if I had it. Apostrophe, there are some falsehoods, Tom, on which men mount, as on bright wings, towards heaven. There are some truths, cold bitter taunting truths, wherein your worldly scholars are very apt and punctual, which bind men down to earth with leaden chains. Who would not rather have to fan him, in his dying hour, the lightest feather of a falsehood such as thine, than all the quills that have been plucked from the sharp porcupine, reproachful truth, since time began? Martin felt keenly for himself, and he felt this good deed of Tom's keenly. After a few minutes it had the effect of raising his spirits, and reminding him that he was not altogether destitute, as he had left a fair stock of clothes behind him, and wore a gold hunting watch in his pocket. He found a curious gratification too, in thinking what a winning fellow he must be, to have made such an impression on Tom, and in reflecting how superior he was to Tom, and how much more likely to make his way in the world. Animated by these thoughts, and strengthened in his design of endeavoring to push his fortune in another country, he resolved to get to London as a rallying point, in the best way he could, and to lose no time about it. He was 10 good miles from the village made illustrious by being the abiding place of Mr. Pecksniff, when he stopped to breakfast at a little roadside alehouse, and resting upon a high back settle before the fire, pulled off his coat, and hung it before the cheerful blaze to dry. It was a very different place from the last tavern in which he had regaled, boasting no greater extent of accommodation than the brick-floored kitchen yielded. But the mind so soon accommodates itself to the necessities of the body, that this poor wagoner's house of call, which he would have despised yesterday, became now quite a choice hotel, while his dish of eggs and bacon, and his mug of beer, were not by any means the coarse fare he had supposed, but fully bore out the inscription on the window shutter, which proclaimed those viands to be good entertainment for travelers. He pushed away his empty plate, and with a second mug upon the hearth before him, looked thoughtfully at the fire until his eyes ached. Then he looked at the highly colored scripture pieces on the walls, in little black frames like common shaving glasses, and saw how the wise men, with a strong family likeness among them, worshipped in a pink manger, and how the prodigal son came home in red rags to a purple father, and already feasted his imagination on the sea-green calf. Then he glanced through the window at the falling rain, coming down the slant upon the signpost over against the house, and overflowing the horse trough, and then he looked at the fire again, and seemed to descry a double distant London, retreating among the fragments of the burning wood. He had repeated this process in just the same order, many times, as if it were a matter of necessity, when the sound of wheels called his attention to the window out of its regular turn, and there he beheld a kind of light van drawn by four horses, and laden, as well as he could see, for it was covered in, with corn and straw. The driver, who was alone, stopped at the door to water his team, and presently came stamping and shaking the wet off his hat and coat, into the room where Martin sat. He was a red-faced burly young fellow, smart in his way, and with a good-humored countenance. As he advanced towards the fire he touched his shining forehead with the forefinger of his stiff leather glove, by way of salutation, and said, rather unnecessarily, that it was an uncommon wet day. "Very wet," said Martin. "I don't know as ever I see a wetter. I never felt one," said Martin. The driver glanced at Martin's soiled dress, and his damp shirt sleeves, and his coat hung up too dry, and said, after a pause, as he warmed his hands, "You have been caught in it, sir?" "Yes," was the short reply. "Out riding, maybe?" said the driver. "I should have been, if I owned a horse. But I don't," returned Martin. "That's bad," said the driver. "And maybe worse," said Martin. Now the driver said that's bad, not so much, because Martin didn't own a horse, as because he said he didn't with all the reckless desperation of his mood and circumstances, and so left a great deal to be inferred. Martin put his hands in his pockets and whistled, when he had retorted on the driver, thus giving him to understand, that he didn't care a pin for fortune, that he was above pretending, to be her favorite when he was not, and that he snapped his fingers at her, the driver, and everybody else. The driver looked at him stealthily for a minute or so, and in the pauses of his warming whistle too. At length he asked, as he pointed his thumb towards the road, "Up or down?" "Which is up?" said Martin. "London, of course," said the driver. "Up then," said Martin. He tossed his head in a careless manner afterwards, as if he would have added, "Now you know all about it." Put his hands deeper into his pockets, changed his tune, and whistled a little louder. "I'm going up," observed the driver, "Hounslow, 10 miles this side London." "Are you?" cried Martin, stopping short and looking at him. The driver sprinkled the fire with his wet hat until it hissed again and answered, "Aye, to be sure he was." "Why then," said Martin, "I'll be plain with you. You may suppose from my dress that I have money to spare. I have not. All I can afford for coach hire is 1 crown, for I have but 2. If you can take me for that, and my waistcoat, or this silk handkerchief, do. If you can't, leave it alone. Apostrophe, short and sweet. Apostrophe remarked the driver. You want more? Apostrophe, apostrophe said Martin. Then I haven't got more, and I can't get it, so there's an end of that. Apostrophe whereupon he began to whistle again. I didn't say I wanted more, did I? Apostrophe, apostrophe asked the driver, with something like indignation. You didn't say my offer was enough, apostrophe rejoined Martin. Why, how could I, when you wouldn't let me? In regard to the waistcoat, I wouldn't have a man's waistcoat, much less a gentleman's waistcoat, on my mind, for no consideration. But the silk handkerchief's another thing, and if you was satisfied, when we got to Hounslow, I shouldn't object to that as a gift. Apostrophe, is it a bargain, then? Apostrophe, apostrophe said Martin. Yes, it is, apostrophe returned the other. Then finish this beer, apostrophe said Martin, handing him the mug, and pulling on his coat with great alacrity, and let us be off, as soon as you like. Apostrophe, in 2 minutes more he had paid his bill, which amounted to a shilling, was lying at full length on a truss of straw, high and dry at the top of the van, with the tilt a little open in front for the convenience of talking to his new friend, and was moving along in the right direction with a most satisfactory and encouraging briskness. The driver's name, as he soon informed Martin, was William Simmons, better known as Bill, and his spruce appearance was sufficiently explained by his connection with a large stagecoaching establishment at Hounslow, whither he was conveying his load from a farm belonging to the concern in Wiltshire. He was frequently up and down the road on such errands, he said, and to look after the sick and rest horses, of which animals he had much to relate that occupied a long time in the telling. He aspired to the dignity of the regular box, and expected an appointment on the first vacancy. He was musical besides, and had a little key bugle in his pocket, on which, whenever the conversation flagged, he played the first part of a great many tunes, and regularly broke down in the second. Ah! Apostrophe, apostrophe said Bill, with a sigh, as he drew the back of his hand across his lips, and put this instrument in his pocket, after screwing off the mouthpiece to drain it. Lummy Ned of the Light Salisbury, he was the one for musical talents. He was a guard. What you may call a garden angel, was Ned. Apostrophe, is he dead? Apostrophe, apostrophe asked Martin. Dead. Apostrophe, apostrophe replied the other, with a contemptuous emphasis. Not he. You won't catch Ned a dying easy. No, no. He knows better than that. Apostrophe, you spoke of him in the past tense, apostrophe observed Martin, so I supposed he was no more. He's no more in England, apostrophe said Bill, if that's what you mean. He went to the United States. Apostrophe, did he? Apostrophe, apostrophe asked Martin, with sudden interest. When? Apostrophe, 5 years ago, or then about, apostrophe said Bill. He had set up in the public line here, and couldn't meet his engagements, so he cut off to Liverpool one day, without saying anything about it, and went and shipped himself for the United States. Apostrophe, well? Apostrophe, apostrophe said Martin. Well, as he landed there without a penny to bless himself with, of course they was very glad to see him in the United States. Apostrophe, what do you mean? Apostrophe, apostrophe asked Martin, with some scorn. What do I mean? Apostrophe, apostrophe said Bill. Why, that. All men are alike in the United States, aren't they? It makes no odds, whether a man has £1,000, or nothing, there. Particular in New York, I'm told, where Ned landed. Apostrophe, New York, was it? Apostrophe, apostrophe asked Martin, thoughtfully. Yes, apostrophe said Bill. New York. I know that, because he sent word home that it brought old York to his mind, quite vivid, in consequence of being so exactly unlike it in every respect. I don't understand what particular business Ned turned his mind to when he got there, but he wrote home that a man his friends was always a-singing, Ail Columbia, and blowing up the president, so I suppose it was something in the public line, or free and easy way again. Anyhow, he made his fortune. Apostrophe, no. Apostrophe, apostrophe, cried Martin. Yes, he did, apostrophe, said Bill. I know that, because he lost it all the day after, in 6 and 20 banks as broke. He settled a lot of the notes on his father, when it was ascertained that they was really stopped, and sent them over with a dutiful letter. I know that, because they was shown down our yard for the old gentleman's benefit, that he might treat himself with tobacco in the workus. Apostrophe, he was a foolish fellow, not to take care of his money when he had it, apostrophe, said Martin, indignantly. There you're right, apostrophe, said Bill, especially as it was all in paper, and he might have took care of it so very easy, by folding it up in a small parcel. Apostrophe, Martin said nothing in reply, but soon afterwards fell asleep, and remained so for an hour more. When he awoke, finding it had ceased to rain, he took his seat beside the driver, and asked him several questions, as how long had the fortunate guard of the light Salisbury been in crossing the Atlantic, at what time of the year had he sailed, what was the name of the ship in which he made the voyage, how much had he paid for passage money, did he suffer greatly from seasickness, and so forth. But on these points of detail his friend was possessed of little or no information, either answering obviously at random or acknowledging that he had never heard, or had forgotten, nor, although he returned to the charge very often, could he obtain any useful intelligence on these essential particulars. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.